For our second All Tech Considered story today, we're going on a treasure hunt. And of course, like everything else, hunting for treasure has gone high tech. Its 21st century equivalent is called geocaching. And our guide on this hunt is Maine Public Radio's Jay Field.
Brad Wing and I barely shake hands before we're speeding south in his four-door Jeep Wrangler. A few hours ago, Wing got a message on his phone. Someone had just hidden a new geocache near a stream a few miles south of Bangor, Maine. This treasure won't make anyone rich. For geocachers like Wing, it's all about the hunt.
I'm actually going to use my smartphone to get us down in the neighborhood because I haven't even loaded into my GPS.
Wing plugs a series of latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates into his phone. To play, cachers sign up for a membership on the sport's website, geocaching.com. That allows them to search for the coordinates of caches stashed all over the world.
I'll go out on a weekend, perhaps find 20 or 30 or 50 of them, and I've done as many as 140 in a day.
There are more than 5 million geocachers worldwide, stalking more than a million hidden caches. The sport draws in people of all ages, from older retirees geocaching their way across the country in RVs, to fitness fanatics who hike, kayak, and climb mountains in search of caches. Geocaching took off in the spring of 2000, shortly after the government officially lifted the restrictions on civilian access to the same highly accurate satellite signals being used by the U.S. military.
The name of the cache is called the Old Trout Hole.
Wing checks his GPS device and turns onto a road leading into the woods.
It's at somebody's favorite fishing spot.
We stop by a stream in front of a culvert. Wing checks crevices between the rocks on one side of the stream. Nothing. Head across the road where finally we see it, hidden between two rocks. Wing unscrews the top of a green canister about the size of a pint of ice cream.
So we're going to open it up and look and see if there's a name on the log sheet yet. Oh, somebody's been here. Two people have been here today.
Most caches, says Wing, are small to medium-sized containers like this one, with a logbook inside and sometimes little doodads.
This one's got a couple of little trinkety things in. It's got a shell and a sticker.
Cachers are free to take what's inside on one condition.
You're supposed to replace it with something of kind of equal or greater value. You know, don't take out a toy truck and put in a rock.
Wing does have other hobbies. He likes to hike, camp, snowshoe, and kayak, activities that he admits frequently lead him back to geocaching.
I don't think I'm totally obsessed with it. Some may disagree, including my wife.
When they were first dating, Wing's wife didn't understand why he spent so much time stashing and searching for booty. That's a far cry from a sack of gold doubloons. But by the time they married, several years ago, Wing's wife had succumbed herself.
One of our other friends had placed a cache outside of the reception hall in a little micro cache out back. You look at some of the videos that were shot of our wedding and you see the bride, the groom, and half the reception flying out the back door. It does make for a real interesting conversation.
For the record, the bride and groom found the cache first. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field in Bangor, Maine.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Here we are, working on a holiday. All of you out there listening, you're probably off work, right? Enjoying a drink, maybe some savory barbecue? Well, perhaps not. Many of us carry around digital leashes to the office, smartphones, iPads, Kindles, that sort of thing. And as NPR's Hansi Luong reports, those devices mean you are always tethered to work.
For Dmitry Popov, a business consultant from Chicago, the day off from work is dead. Time of death? As soon as he hears this.
I took off work, but with the promise that I would be periodically checking emails.
And returning phone calls and text messages from coworkers on his day off. He's spending it in an upscale hotel in Washington, D.C., where he's volunteering at a conference about his home country, Macedonia. But in between the panels and networking events, it's back to work in front of the laptop.
at any point in any day, weekend, weekday, you're expected to return phone calls, return emails, and there's really no shutoff point.
Popov says in his line of work, he always has to stay connected, even when he's far away from the office.
I mean, I feel it's a good thing for my boss, and I guess it's a good thing for me in the sense that I have to meet certain deadlines.
This is a concept that I refer to as blackberries on the beach.
That's Tony Onsidi. He's a lawyer in Los Angeles who specializes in labor and employment law.
It's a shorthand reference to the fact that employees today can sort of log on and be productive from just about any location on Earth.
There may be some places left to get off the grid, the middle of the ocean or on a mountaintop. But those quiet places are disappearing. In an age of smartphones, remote access, and now video calling, the space-age world of the Jetsons doesn't seem so far off. Remember those video phones George Jetson's boss would use to check in on his employees?
Jetson! Caught you again! Now stop goofing off on my time!
Your time! Yes, sir! Yes, sir!
The time employees spend out of the office on mobile devices for work has become a concern for some employers. Last year, a Chicago police sergeant filed a lawsuit against the city of Chicago. He claims the city owes him overtime for all the time he spent on his BlackBerry for work while off duty. The case is still in court. Tony Onsidi says the Fair Labor Standards Act has strict rules on overtime for American workers who are paid by the hour.
Even if the employee has not been specifically asked to answer emails after hours on a device or by remote access avenue, but the employer permits the employee to do so, then the employer owes that employee that overtime.
Even if that's time spent texting from the beach. That BlackBerries on the beach concept Onsidi referred to earlier, it's something Lisa Regan, who's in sales, says she knows too well.
I have a BlackBerry in the bag, my cell phone over here, a separate one, and a computer back at the townhouse.
Regan's spending the weekend on a beach in Delaware. How does she feel about staying so connected with work?
I hate it. I'd rather it not happen, but with my field, other people might need my help, so I don't mind, I guess.
For some employees, though, there's still an option to go offline for the weekend. Brian Nelson brought his iPhone to the beach, but...
I haven't looked at my email in 3 days, which I'm sort of happy about. It's going to hit me when I get home.
That's right. He'll be checking his work email from home. Hanzi Luong, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. For the past few days, thousands of people have been submitting questions on Twitter with the hashtag AskObama. Today, the president answered some of those questions in what the White House dubbed its first Twitter town hall. NPR's Ari Shapiro was in the White House East Room for the tweets.
President Obama has done town hall meetings with Facebook and YouTube. Today, it was Twitter's turn, and he opened it with a first.
I am going to make history here as the first president to live tweet.
On a laptop with a presidential seal, he typed out his question to the American people. It popped up on a large screen.
In order to reduce the deficit, what costs would you cut and what investments would you keep?
At the end of the town hall, the president responded to some Twitter users' answers to that question. In the intervening hour, he talked about jobs, education, the debt ceiling, even space travel. The questions were all 140 characters max. The answers, no such limit.
One last point. I know Twitter, I'm supposed to be short, but...
Twitter founder Jack Dorsey moderated the conversation. At one point, Dorsey pulled up a tweet from one of President Obama's new golfing buddies, House Speaker John Boehner.
After embarking on a record-spending binge that left us deeper in debt, where are the jobs?
The president called it a slightly skewed question. He accused Republicans of blocking investments in infrastructure and other areas that the White House believes could create jobs.
We haven't gotten the kind of cooperation that I'd like to see on some of those ideas and initiatives, but I'm just going to keep on trying, and eventually I'm sure the speaker will see the light.
The president also said Boehner is falling down on the job by threatening not to raise the federal debt ceiling.
Congress has a responsibility to make sure we pay our bills. We've always paid them in the past. The notion that the U.S. is going to default on its debt is just irresponsible.
That's an accusation President Obama can level at the House Speaker in person when Boehner visits the White House for negotiations tomorrow. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.